On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Arthur Sena lived in a hole near the railroad tracks in Denver. Rodney Little Bear spent 15 years on the streets, in and out of jail, homeless shelters, and emergency rooms in Seattle. Chronically homeless, alcoholic, ex-Marine Murray Barr cost the city of Reno maybe $1 million over 10 years in hospital bills and substance abuse treatment. Now Barr is dead and a legend. Million Dollar Murray is written up recently by Tipping Point's Malcolm Gladwell. But Sena and Little Bear have been taken off the streets in a new national campaign against chronic homelessness called Housing First. Take the hardcore off the streets, let them drink, let them live, but give them a home. Up next on Point, a new attack on homelessness. Joining me in the studio is Philip Mangano, Bush appointee, Housing First champion, and head of the Interagency Council on Homelessness in Washington. He's worked with the homeless for over 25 years, starting on the front lines on a downtown Boston breadline. Philip Mangano, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me here today, Tom. It's good to be with you.
What are you up to here?
Well, as you mentioned, I'm originally from Boston, and if you're born in Boston, you're born an abolitionist. You see a social wrong, you want to right it. You see a social evil, you want to end it. And I think it's no less true of this issue that we're confronted with today in our country, homelessness, than it was the efforts to put the Bill of Rights in the Constitution, to end slavery, to expand suffrage, to make certain that civil rights were extended. So it's all one long story, and homelessness is part of that story now.
But you're breaking homelessness into a couple of pieces here and focusing on the chronic homeless, and as I read here, some impressive numbers in response in Philadelphia, street people down 60% over 5 years. San Francisco, chronic homeless down 28%, Dallas 26%. Why are you singling out the chronic homeless, and what is this? I mean, you hear the right wing kind of slang on it. Maybe right wing is the wrong word. I don't know. You're with the Bush administration, but bunks for drunks. Why the chronic homeless? Who are the chronic homeless? And why a home before anything else, before sort of cleaning up?
Well, Tom, after 20 years of attempting to set policy by virtue of anecdote, conjecture, and feelings, what we've done is we've simply taken what's known as the president's management agenda of all things, which simply says that any federal investment should be data and research driven, should be performance-based. That is, it should have a direction. Mm-hmm. It should have a purpose to it. And then finally, and most importantly, it should be results-oriented. It should be an investment that secures a return on that investment, not in Wall Street or Dow Jones terms, but in terms of the lives of citizens of our country.
How does that take you to the chronic homeless?
So what we've done is we've followed what the research told us. In the late 1990s, a researcher by the name of Dr. Dennis Culhane at the University of Pennsylvania and other researchers around the country told us that there was a cohort of homeless people, namely people who had a disability and who were long-term homeless. They numbered only between 10 and 20% of the whole population, but they were consuming half of all the resources that we were investing in homeless shelter programs and emergency responses. What the research also said is the other 80% of homeless people came into homelessness and moved out pretty much on their own, and that this population needed additional resources and additional prioritization. So what we've done is simply followed what the research and the data have indicated. So we focused on people experiencing chronic homelessness.
Malcolm Gladwell of Tipping Point fame, New Yorker writer, took up this story in the New Yorker earlier this year, told the story of one Murray Barr in Reno, Nevada. Murray, big guy, ex-Marine, alcoholic, been in and out of hospital and jail and on the streets for a decade in Reno. Everybody loved him, but they ended up calculating that he cost Reno about $1 million. Million Dollar Murray, Malcolm's always catchy. That was his catchy headline. Is this the example of what you don't want to happen?
Well, exactly what we've learned is not only is this group of homeless people, namely the people experiencing chronic homelessness, not only are they expensive in homelessness, but they're also very expensive in mainstream programs. These are the people who are randomly ricocheting into the emergency room of hospitals, into the acute side of behavioral health, in other words, substance abuse and mental health programs. And they're also taking a disproportionate amount of law enforcement, court, and temporary periods of incarceration. When you add up all those numbers, which they did in Reno, which they've done done in cities all across our country. San Diego is another great story. The city, after accommodating homelessness for 20 years, finally determined that they needed to do something different. They took a timeout. They got the University of California at San Diego to do a study. They followed just 15 chronic homeless people over 18 months and discovered that in emergency rooms and law enforcement and other health costs, they cost over $3 million, an average of $200,000 per person to the city and county. Well, that started them planning in a different way.
So in very practical terms, what does this mean? You go to the real hard cases on the streets, people who officials tend to know because they're there for a long time, and you say, here are the keys. Here's an apartment. Drink, don't drink. It's up to you. How's it work?
Well, there have been many different approaches to homelessness and to this population. There are many traditional programs that work for people who are higher functioning, but there have always been fallout from those programs, and those are the people that we see on the streets, people who haven't been able to be compliant and deferential in programs, who get dismissed from those programs.
In the shelters, in the substance abuse programs.
In shelters and in other programs. They fall, and they fall into the street. And they were literally being left behind. For a decade, no attention was being paid to them. Their numbers were increasing all over the country. This administration, beginning with the president's commitment in his 2003 budget to Congress, the president set a new marker in front of the country, and that was to end the homelessness of those who were the most disabled, most vulnerable, most likely to be living
and dying
on the streets.
But exactly what do you give them? How do you do it? How's it work?
Well, the way it's been
housing
working
first.
Around the country is that these folk are part of an effort where local provider agencies or departments of public health or managed care companies, it's happened in a number of different ways. They engage these people through a technology called the Assertive Community Treatment Team, which is simply to say you send out a team of people to engage these people, not one recently graduated college student who often led to
a team, and
outreach.
You say, we've got a home for you right now. Come on, it's yours.
Basically, that's what happens. And after a brief transition period, people are escorted to their own apartment. Usually it's a room or a small apartment, and people are situated there, and a variety of services are made available to them. In fact, it's an enriched set of services, because what we've learned is it's far less expensive to keep them in housing with services than it is to allow them to randomly ricochet through expensive systems.
So they're encouraged to clean up afterward. They're supported in that, but it's not a prerequisite. They don't have to keep the bottle off the shelf. I want to turn to someone who's been through just this process, if we may. We're talking with Philip Mangano, Executive Director of the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness. They're pushing housing first. With us right now from Quincy, Massachusetts, is Paula Curry. She knows a lot about it firsthand, formerly homeless resident of Quincy, 48 years old, been living in housing first, permanent housing in Quincy since December of last year, after 7 years on the streets. Paula Curry, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
So you've been there. You've seen it firsthand. Is this different, Paula? Is it different from the programs you saw in the past? Is it working better for you and for others who have done some hard time on the streets?
Yes, it's working very good. It's working much better.
You've got a history of chronic alcoholism. You were not asked to beat that before you came in here. You were simply invited in?
Yes, I was still active drinking.
And what about your experience since you got this housing, sort of housing first before anything else? How's it working? Are you getting other help along with that? Do you find your life getting onto a better track?
Yes, I do. They helped me with the alcoholism. And, I'm getting counseling. And they gave me the room without having to go to a program. I had cirrhosis of the liver, which I still do. Mm-hmm. I was throwing up blood. They were bringing me to the hospital and, getting my medication, stuff like that.
Paula, does it feel like a new way, a new day for you with this approach, or just another version of the same old?
Oh, no, it's very good. It's nothing like being out in the streets. You get your own room. It's a roof over your head. It's not like, being outside sleeping underneath a tree or in a car or in an abandoned house.
Are you with other former homeless people in your housing environment there?
Yes, there's 12 of us.
And when you talk about it with them, does it, is it the consensus there that this is a better way? And do you see you know, the majority of them doing better in this system than they did, as you say, you know, bouncing around.
Oh, yes, they're doing much, much better. And they get all the support and help, you know, the Father Bill's staff.
Paula, what about the critics who say, you know, why are we giving houses to people who haven't cleaned up their act at all? People should sort of get clean and sober and then get the reward of housing.
Well, because they need a chance and they need somebody, you know, to help them along. And that's what the staff does here. They help you, you know, get into programs and detoxes and, you know, physical and mental
assistance there. Do you fear or feel that you could end up on the street again, or do you think, you know, you're really on a new path here? How's it feel?
No, I don't feel that I'll be back out on the streets. I feel that I'm on a new path, going upwards instead of downwards.
Paula, we really hope it works for you, and we're glad you found that path, and we're grateful to you for sharing your thoughts on it with us today. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Okay, you're welcome.
Paula Curry, formerly homeless, now in a Housing First program in Quincy, Massachusetts. Philip Mangano, there's a story. There's Exhibit A, I guess.
Well, I think one of the most important things about that story and so many stories around our country is that when you go out and actually talk to homeless people, when you talk to people who are experiencing chronic homelessness, they never ask for a pill, a program, or a protocol. They ask for one thing, a place to live.
Take us to these numbers again, Philip Mangano. We read about something like 750,000 Americans homeless on any given night, maybe 200,000 of them the chronic homeless that you're talking about. But that leaves more than 500,000 others, often families, more often than ever today with children. Does your program, your focus on the chronically homeless, shortchange those who suddenly find themselves up against it?
Well, first
of all,
the United States Interagency Council in Washington, our first priority is to bring all 20 federal agencies together. We meet regularly at the White House. We've made record resources available targeted to homelessness for 5 years in a row. The president's budget in Congress right now has a sixth consecutive year of increased resources. We certainly have a priority on those who are dying on the streets of our country, who are the most disabled and the most vulnerable. And while we have that priority, we still have a good grip on homeless families and non-disabled individuals. For example, HUD, Housing and Urban Development, which provides the most resources out on the streets of our country, actually more than half of those resources go directly to families. So we're certainly moving forward and targeting homeless families, but we have a priority for those people who are literally dying on the streets. When I go around the country and I look at the death lists in cities, which I unfortunately do, the people who populate the death lists of homeless people in our country are people experiencing chronic homelessness. There are no moms and dads and children, thank God, on those lists. But these are the people on those lists. We want the numbers to go down. We want the numbers to attrit, not through death, but through solutions.
Let's turn to Burlington, Massachusetts, and Michael. Hi, Michael. You're on the air. What do you think, Michael?
Yes. Well, I think first of all, we're an extremely rich country, and I think it's an affront to I think we should be proud enough that we don't want people dying in our streets. And I think it basically works out to the idea of, should people deserve to die because they can't stop being drunks?
Is it as simple as that, Michael? Should just bring them into the house because otherwise it's a death sentence, or that possibility, as Philip says?
Yeah, and I think that if you're living on the street, being a drunk makes a lot of sense.
Philip?
And you know what, Michael, I so appreciate what you're saying there, because I think we've forgotten alcoholism, addiction, they're a disease. The American Psychiatric Society, the American Hospital Association, the American Medical Society, the American Social Work, we've all committed to the fact that alcoholism is a disease. It actually began with Benjamin Rush, signer of the Declaration of Independence, the personal doctor to George Washington. He said alcoholism is a disease. Well, we've forgotten that it's a disease. We think it's a choice that people make. So, in fact, the intervention that we're attempting to do here is to treat somebody with a disease. If we knew somebody had some other disease, would we leave them on the streets, ask them to cure themselves, and then welcome them in, or would we take them in? So I think your point is well taken, Michael.
Let's take a call from Iowa City, Iowa. Mary is on the line. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Thank you. You know, this is the only part of Bush Christianity that's working, because Jesus said we're supposed to be the Good Samaritan.
Mm-hmm.
These people don't have to straighten up and fly right. We have to help them. And, you know, about 60% of those people you see homeless are veterans. So I guess he's getting ready for the Iraq war to, you know, when they send him back home, because we've made no preparations for these people.
So, Mary, are you giving the president applause or a sting here?
Well, you have to give the devil his due. So, you know, if we're supposed to be these good Christians and we're going to Christianize the world, we better get our act together. We can't help anybody until we help ourselves. And I'm tired of seeing homeless people, and I'm tired of hearing about homeless veterans. It just gets to a point where you're just worn out emotionally.
Yeah, Mary, we hear it. Philip Mangano, the devil his due. Mary says this is the only place she sees President Bush's Christianity at work. Is this a faith-based effort? How do you respond to her observation?
Well, first of all,
praise and criticism.
Yeah, there's no question that faith-based communities have been on the front lines of homelessness for over 25 years. So certainly it's part of that effort, but it also makes a lot of sense not only in spiritual and moral terms, but now we understand that it makes sense in economic terms. And I appreciate Mary talking about we need to be Samaritans, because for the last several years, the president has included in his budget something called the Samaritan Initiative. This year it was $200 million specifically targeted to people who are on the streets of our country to remedy their street homelessness, to ensure that they have a place to go, not to leave them behind. So it is part of a spiritual and economic and moral effort on the part of this administration.
Have you taken heat from moralists in the Christian right saying, don't hand out houses to alcoholics and drug abusers, Mr. Mangano?
I've been on a few conservative talk shows, I have to admit, Tom. Not all are as civil as this one. And I'd say heat would be the appropriate word. The Bunsen burners were turned up. And I've also gotten some criticism from the left on this, that the focusing on this population detracts from focuses on other populations. Just isn't true. People haven't done their homework, but those are the accusations. But recently, I have to tell you this, recently I got notes from a conservative fundraiser for the president applauding this effort. And I also got a note from Barney Frank, congressman, one of the most liberal fellows in Congress, applauding this effort. So it cuts both ways. And I think people are, in fact, giving the president the credit that is due on this initiative targeted to the streets of our country.
So some bouquets here, but some brickbats also.
No question.
You've done some work along these lines. It's been done recently in Seattle. Right now from Seattle, we're joined by John Carlson, radio talk show host there of Seattle's John Carlson Show, a lifelong Seattleite, Republican, host of two radio programs in Seattle, was Republican nominee for governor of Washington State in 2000, won the primary, lost to the incumbent. John Carlson, thanks very much for being with us. You've been very critical of this. You've called this bunks for drunks. Where's the compassion piece?
Well, I think compassion is important, but compassion has to be very strategic. It has to be smart. Otherwise, you can actually make a problem worse. And that, especially with helping the homeless, if you don't do it right, not only will you not make things better, but you will make things worse. And that's my major concern with this particular program. I think that it's an example of where the safety net, and I believe in safety net, become a hammock.
A hammock for the chronically homeless. I mean, a hammock is a bed. Don't they deserve a bed?
It's a bed where you just hang out. And you know, let me put my perspective forward here for the listeners. I think that our programs to help not just the homeless but the down and out, those who need help from others, should be designed the way we would help someone we love, someone in our own family. And so if your brother, say, had a bad drinking problem and he wanted you to give him money to go out and get smokes and a couple of 40-ouncers every day and then wanted you to provide him a place to come back and drink and hang out with his friends and then spend the night and then, you know, wash, repeat, rinse, do the same thing the next day, day after that, and then the next day after that, would you let him?
Philip Mangano, John Carlson saying you're a facilitator here of the kind of behavior that takes people to the street.
Well, I certainly appreciate John's perspective. We do know, and we have learned all during the 1990s, that often well-intended policies have unintended consequences. We knew that through deinstitutionalization, well-intended, but it led to pervasive street homelessness. That's exactly what we have in our view here, something that remedies the wrong of the deinstitutionalization that led to pervasive street homelessness. And I agree with John. If we were simply allowing people to drink and there were no services available, they could just keep going out, doing it over and over again. But we heard from Paula, and what I know from visiting the program in Seattle, is that there are enriched social services, all with the intent of remedying the ravages of this disease. So it's not simply letting them be on a hammock or simply being lying in a bed, actually, but the services are there to bring remedy to a disease. So I think John makes good points, but I think we've gone that one step further. We don't want to know the unintended consequences of this. We want this actually to bring solutions to people's lives.
John, you've got 75 new residents of a Housing First facility there in Seattle. Philip Mangano says, look, they're not just hanging out. They're getting treated for exactly the kind of problems you describe.
No, and
not good enough?
I hire Philip, and I've had him on my show as well when he was in Seattle. It's not a question of services. It's a question of asking something of the person receiving the service. It's about responsibility. It's about accountability. And if you look at the homeless programs that work, they do provide food and shelter and job training and 12-step. However, they also have rules. They also have expectations. And you are expected to measure up to those expectations. That's what's missing here. All you have to do is hang out. And that's why I say a safety net has become a hammock. And I wonder what impact this will have on maybe encouraging and enabling others who are just on the verge of maybe committing to overcome their problem or maybe falling back into drinking every day to do just that.
So you want some responsibility, accountability. Philip's saying Housing First. Let's get another perspective from the field. We've got a call from Stamford, Connecticut. Rick is on the line. Hi, Rick. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm the former director of a local shelter. According to the Social Security Administration, 95% of the people who have substance abuse issues who are homeless are self-medicating mental health issues. It's disingenuous just to focus on the substance abuse issues. Get people into housing, address mental health issues, and everything else will fall into place.
And do you see the housing piece as critical to addressing that? Or what about addressing it in the street, Rick?
Absolutely. Having somebody in, whether it's an SRO or housing, whatever it is, getting them off the street will really calm down mental health issues.
But what about John Carlson's perspective in Seattle? He's worried about this becoming just a kind of a lounge for, you know, for bad behavior.
My philosophy at my shelter was, we're not your home, but we're here till you get home. I totally disagree with John. You know, we're working with getting people into housing. We're working with trying to address people's behaviors. Not to be, it ought to be a safety net, but not to be that hammock that he's referring to.
Rick, thanks for calling. Yes, please, John.
Where do you then draw the distinction between a safety net and a hammock?
Philip Mangano?
I think it's important to look at what the alternatives are for these people. John is quite right in saying that there are a number of programs out there, traditional programs, that do work for a lot of people. But there are a lot of people for whom those programs do not work. People can't be compliant in those programs. Those are the very people who fall to the streets. I applaud the programs that work, missions and Salvation Armies, that have worked historically. But many people cannot measure up to the compliance and the responsibilities of those programs. Those are the people who fall to the streets. What's the alternative when those people fall to the streets? Either they're randomly ricocheting very expensively in systems, and to me, I always learned that a conservative philosophy would be one that would be cost-effective and cost-efficient in terms of working with people and getting better outcomes and results in their lives. There's nothing that we've discovered that better gets those outcomes, that reduces the cost and puts people on a trajectory toward becoming self-sufficient in terms of those people who have been left behind, than this Housing First initiative.
John Carlson, let me ask you about that. Let's say you were completely in the tough love camp, and I hear you more on that side of this, but we saw the story Malcolm Gladwell wrote about it in the New Yorker of Million Dollar Murray. It cost Reno, Nevada $1 million over 10 years. Even if you looked at this just as an accountant, very cold-eyed, is there an argument economically here that this is much more a cost-effective way of dealing with the problem, whatever you think about the morals of it?
There is that argument, and I've seen the numbers. I don't quite believe the numbers because the costs of this center in Seattle are higher than they anticipated. They weren't factoring in a lot of ambulance calls, but they've had over 120 of them in just a few months to the center. And so, again, I have to look at whether or not we are helping someone get better or whether we're simply providing a place for them to get worse.
Let me take a call from Bill. He's calling from Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. I grew up with homeless people up in Maine. And by the way, it's an honor to speak to you. And I know you're not going to believe this, but I'm a hardcore Republican. And the homeless people, we should give them a home. We waste money on everything else in this country. And those people do not want to be up there. Out on the street like that, I grew up with those people. And every one of them, if you give them a chance, most of them will do the best that they can. And for us not to supply them a home is absolutely horrible.
So you don't see it as handing them a hammock and an easy life?
Handing them a hammock. We got them living on the street. They're worried about their lives. The people that talk like that, if they had to spend 3 days on the street, they'd be curled up in a ball crying like a baby. They wouldn't be able to survive. Of course they don't. Not a hammock. I'm sorry if I'm a little emotional. It's just a really tough subject when you've grown up with those people, you know?
Bill, we hear it, and we appreciate your passion on it. Philip Mangano, there's the two views. You know, you're sliding here from safety net to hammock, or, as Bill says, from on the road there in Pawtucket. Come on, I grew up with these people. They don't want to be on the street.
I think John Carlson's views in Seattle, they're appropriate. There's skepticism about this. I had skepticism when I first heard about Housing First. I had been involved in homelessness for 20 years. Mm. I never heard of putting people directly off the streets into housing. I didn't believe it. I had to go see it for myself. So I did. I went to New York and I went to San Francisco. I saw it. I went to the apartments of the people who were living there. I heard their stories about living on the streets for 5, 10, and 15 years. Now they were in housing. I looked at their lives and I recognized that there were results there. I went to San Francisco and other cities. Consistently, the research indicates that people get their lives together in Housing First programs. 85% of the people placed in Housing First programs stay there over time. We have to be more creative for the other 15%, but this is working for people who are thought to be intractably homeless.
John Carlson, are you the minority there in Seattle? Or are most people supporting this so far? What's the response been?
No, in terms of when the public's been polled or when the public's spoken out about this, there's a great deal of opposition to it. If it's okay, I'd like to ask Philip a question. Philip, the question is, how the other homeless shelters that you admire, Salvation Army, Union Gospel Mission, etc., what is their take
on Housing First?
As far as I know, they haven't been polled. I think in speaking with many of them, they're looking at Housing First as a possibility. Also, I just want to mention, John, you mentioned that there were a lot of ambulance visits to the center there in Seattle. That's absolutely true, because when people are on the street, they learn to dial 911. And exactly what's happening in Housing First programs is people are learning a different way to get their health care taken care of.
John Carlson, thanks very much for being with us. Kathy's calling from Nashville. Hi, Kathy. You're on the air.
Hi. First of all, I want to applaud this effort. I think the fact that this is not a one-size-fits-all, that this is going for perhaps a smaller percentage of the homeless population, mm-hmm. but a chronic percentage, I think is fabulous. I think very often the far right becomes agitated whenever a program is not a one-size-fits-all program, because they want everything to kind of funnel in one direction.
Well, this is certainly focused on the chronically homeless.
Definitely. I have a more centrist position, but I'm excited about the fact that this is not creating a revolving door. My interest is in the health outcomes as far as the data goes. I personally have a chronic illness, so I'm frequently in the hospital, mm-hmm. and I often go in through the emergency room.
Right.
And I know I constantly live close to a large university medical center,
yeah.
And that's where I get my health care. The staff in the emergency room literally know the homeless folks there on a first-name basis.
You can't go to an emergency room and not see it. I was there with my wife and the guy right next to her covered in rat bites. I mean, really in terrible trouble.
And so I guess my question is, and also on a personal note, my father-in-law committed suicide 6 years ago, and he had a dual diagnosis issue and was facing going from being an executive to homelessness due to dual diagnosis.
What does dual diagnosis mean?
Dual diagnosis is when you have a mental illness, mm-hmm. combined with being able, trying to self-medicate either
right.
through illicit drugs or through alcoholism.
So your question is, how do the ongoing health issues get addressed?
Once I go into these mm-hmm. these housing programs, what does the data look like as far as the health outcomes? And I realize this is a newer program, but long term, did the ambulance visits start tapering off? And what kind of illnesses are we looking at? Are we looking at cirrhosis of the liver? What are most of these hospital admissions and high ambulance bills related to when they're on the streets? And then what does the resolution look like, or what are the outcomes that we're looking for once they get into housing as far as how their health picture changes?
Kathy, those are great questions. We can feel your intimacy with the issues and wish you good luck. Philip Mangano, how about it?
Well, Kathy, I so appreciate your support and also your questions. It's a wide variety of different maladies that people face who live on the street, leg and foot ailments, cirrhosis of the liver, other kinds of ailments, diabetes. And what programs that have been existing for a long time, Housing First in New York City, for example, and in San Francisco, there is some longer-term research. And what the research is conclusive about is that the need for chronic medical care tapers off as people gain stability in housing. What we don't realize, those of us who have been housed our whole lives, is that housing itself has a therapeutic impact on the lives of people who have been living on the street. Their symptoms reduce. And then with the provision of those enriched social services to people, what we've seen in the programs that existed for a long time and some of the newer programs is, in fact, that people are better taken care of. More preventive work is done on their health care so that the health doesn't have to deteriorate into extreme conditions. And what that does is, of course, it saves resources. It saves time and resources in the emergency room of hospitals. It saves time and resources in mental health and in substance abuse programs. So conclusively, the studies have indicated savings and better health for people who go into Housing First.
And fewer emergency rooms, we hope. I want to get another very knowing perspective on this. Joining us from Los Angeles is Bob Erlenbusch. He's executive director of the Los Angeles Coalition to End Hunger and Homelessness, private nonprofit group. He's also president of the board of directors of the National Coalition for the Homeless. Bob Erlenbusch, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
You've been decidedly critical of this Housing First approach, or at least the singular focus on it. Why, Bob?
Well, let's set the record straight. Housing First was developed by Tanya Tull, the executive director of Beyond Shelter, a methodology more than 15 years ago. And, you know, rather than advocates catching up to data-driven, proven methodologies, it took government, and this is not directed at Philip Mangano, this mm-hmm. is directed at previous administrations, to catch up to what nonprofits knew, that you could take not only single individuals, quote-unquote chronically homeless, but also families, youth, off the streets, into housing, to do all the positive outcomes that Philip's already mentioned.
And we're still catching up with this today, and want to understand your unease with the Housing First push
I mean,
as it's underway.
The unease is that, you know, I appreciate Philip's perspective and mantra, if you will, that we need to be data-driven. If we are going to be data-driven, the reality is that we've got millions of people who are homeless, not just the chronic homeless, but youth and families, and increasingly seniors.
Millions. I'm reading in the New York Times 700,000. Is there
yeah.
are there different definitions?
Well,
you say millions.
Yeah, there's broader definitions. We can 700,000 to maybe 2 million depends on
okay.
how you count. Mm-hmm. But the reality is 700,000 to a million or two too many.
Does dealing with the chronically homeless
right.
somehow shortchange those who are more briefly homeless?
What dealing with the chronically homeless assumes is that we've got limited resources. What in this country, nothing could be further from the truth. It depends on what our priorities are. And I think it's disingenuous to the Bush administration to say we're going to focus our resources on the chronically homeless, abandoning in some way youth and families, not totally, but still shifting resources, when at the same time the very permanent housing programs that could help families and single individuals, the very population, are being sliced and diced. And let me give you a couple examples.
Yep.
Section 8, which is federally subsidized housing, over the last 2 years, the number of families that have been on eligible for Section 8 has fallen over 200,000. The current Bush administration's proposals for funding FY or fiscal year 2006 is 95% of the need. So we're not even getting close to meeting the need of families on welfare, families with disabilities. The President's Office of Management and Budget wants to make deep cuts to housing, food stamps, Medicaid, community development block grant.
So it's leaving too much off the table. Let me get Philip Mangano in, and we'll come back right back to you, Bob.
But okay, thank you.
Philip, how about it? You know, the suggestion here, in a way, that with a program like this, you pretty up the streets, you make us feel good about dealing with the hard cases, but you leave a big problem unaddressed, Bob Erlenbush is charging.
Well, first of all, I appreciate Bob's perspective in terms of where Housing First came from. It certainly came from the country, from innovators around the country who made it happen. And government is indeed catching up with the technologies that have been made available. With regard to leaving anyone behind, youth, families, or elderly, there's just no sense to that.
The Section 8 cutbacks?
Because, in fact, we're making substantial investments in each of those homeless populations. With regard to the budget matters, you never know what's going to happen in a budget, as I learned in the many years I worked in Massachusetts, until the dust clears on a budget. The reality is that the president included $1.1 billion increases to Section 8 both last year and this year.
And Congress changed those?
And the House and the Senate, for FY07, which is the budget in front of the Congress right now, they've actually ensured that those increases will, in fact, be in the budget. So what we know from preliminary reports, both from the House and from the Senate just this week, is that they were agreeing with the president that, in fact, both segments of the Section 8 program need an increase. They're getting it. What Bob is rightfully concerned about is that even though we're increasing the resources that are available, because rents have gone up in many parts of the country, unfortunately, those dollars are being absorbed in those rent increases. And in some places, not as many families are being served. But the Bush administration has actually asked for increases in those programs. And there are a number of other housing programs in which the president and the Congress, between the president and Congress, actually there will be increases. As I'm looking at the numbers here, in most of the housing programs. Is it enough? No, it's never enough. It hasn't been enough in this administration. It hasn't been enough in the past administration. But the trajectory of what we're doing on homelessness is the right trajectory.
Bob, let me ask you, you see a contradiction, a kind of open-handedness with the chronic cases, the hard cases, but a different message for families, maybe families with children, in a tight spot?
Well, exactly. I mean, the reality is that Philip is correct. The administration has asked for more money in Section 8, but we're still falling behind in Section 8 because what HUD has done is demand that the housing authorities around the country not serve the neediest anymore, but up the income level for people who are eligible. We are going to see more homeless families on the street because of the flawed formula for Section 8. And to be fair, the president's budget does call for big cuts in community development block grant, housing for seniors, and housing for people with disabilities. The reality is that HUD has not come out as strong advocates, driven by data, to say, you know what, we've got 700,000 to a million people. We need a response to match the scale. And they've not taken a stand on the National Housing Trust Fund, which would build $1.5 million homes, nor the National Coalition for the Homeless proposal that Representative Julia Carson is carrying, an omnibus bill to end homelessness and prevent homelessness, the Bringing America Home Act. We need a bold response from any administration to match the scale of the crisis.
Philip Mangano, I'll get your response on that, but I want to hear first from a caller, Chris, calling in from Boston. Hi, Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you kindly.
Yeah.
I'm formerly homeless, and I've got my disability. I got very lucky to have Section 8 apartment, having a Section 8 apartment.
Okay.
I was being treated for dual diagnosis.
Right.
And for me, I'm not sure if any of you, any of the listeners, are familiar with Maslow's pyramid of needs.
Okay, yeah, sort of the basics, yeah.
Once my housing issue was solved, now one thing I think that people are stereotyping the homeless to be all these alcoholics and crazy people, but there's a big thing of an underreported thing of having families, having women with kids, single mothers with kids.
So, Chris, how do you see it? Do you see this Housing First focus on the chronically homeless who often are struggling with substance abuse problems or mental illness? Do you see that as a too tight a focus? Do you see that as shortchanging
it's
the families?
All a matter, excuse me for saying this. It's, it's a matter of personal responsibility. And I understand there's a growing trend to be to have shelters be dry shelters.
Mm-hmm.
So if people want the help and they want the housing, then they have to be clean and sober. And in my experience, a lot of the homeless shelter places have the possibility for someone to try to get off drugs. And I still worry about the concern of, or my concern is, the deserving and undeserving poor. Now, I believe, or what, from my own personal experience, once I got away from the shelter system into my own house, it was easier for me to get a job because I had a stable address.
Sure.
And my concerns went from being, you know, where am I going to stay in the middle of winter?
But are you saying that, that there are some undeserving or the opposite, Chris?
Well, I think that people put it in that kind of, bear with me for a minute, That kind of way of thinking that...
And do you approve of that when you say personal responsibility? Are you saying we've got undeserving who shouldn't be giving housing?
No, it's a paradigm. The paradigm of people's perceptions about being homeless, that most of them are drug addicts
yep.
and single men.
Yep.
And we leave out the thing of people who are homeless just for lack of money.
Chris, our time grows short, but I appreciate your perspective, and glad you found your feet there. Bob, how about it? Those who aren't chronic, but float in and out, what's the profile? Has Chris got it? Is this families and children, not single men with a rack of issues?
Well, I mean, the chronic homeless vary from 10 to 20%, where in Los Angeles it's the sky high because of the lack of investment in programs like Philip's been talking about, which is up over 40%. But that still leaves, you know, 60 to 80% of homeless people that we're not addressing in a full and bold way. And let me just make, I mean, I just want your listeners to be clear.
Mm-hmm.
The National Coalition, the LA Coalition, totally support the Housing First model, but feel that it's disingenuous to say you're going to end homelessness for one part of the population when you're cutting the very housing programs that will lead people off the streets and still leave people to suffer on the streets. And I would take great exception with the perspective that the people who are dying on the streets are exclusively or are single adults. In general, I think Philip is correct, but the point that is lost is that many of those single adults are parents.
Mm.
They're mom and dad separated from their children.
So kids are involved here too.
I would challenge anybody, especially the mom who lost her children, who lost a child because of asthma due to roach-infested living conditions or being bit by rats, that children and moms and dads do die either on the streets or in programs.
Mm. Bob Erlenbusch in L.A., president of the board of directors of the National Coalition for the Homeless. Bob, thanks for being with us. Philip, our time is short. The last issue on the table, is there a moral contradiction here? Going hard for the chronically homeless, Bob says, not doing enough for the balance.
Well, I certainly appreciate the urgency that Bob has. That's what advocates bring to the table, is that urgency. But the notion that resources somehow don't matter, they do matter, and there are finite resources. And that's what we learned from research, is that when you have a big social problem and a little bit of new resources, you have to invest them in intelligent action, as Malcolm Gladwell tells us, in the most visible expression of the problem, to bring change to what's deemed to be intractable. And by bringing change to that population, you can create a tipping point for the whole social problem. They've done that in England in their initiative around...
Are we going to see Housing First as national policy? Is it going to be everywhere? It's in I don't know how many communities now.
Certainly, as it continues to produced the kind of results that we're looking for, moving people off the streets, out of long-term shelter stays. You'll see more and more Housing First initiatives around our country.
Well, look for it on a block near you. Philip Mangano, Bush appointee, Executive Director of the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness. Philip, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.